think of looking. I've been kind of shocked too at the. I think I said in one of my letters to the editor, the meekness of the response has been kind of shocking. And I guess I blame myself as well. Maybe there's something difficult and distracting about this particular situation. I remember talking to somebody in the first few days of this campaign, someone that I would judge to be extremely anti, you know, this kind of violence, and they were confused, very confused about what to do and whether or not this might be justified. I think there was a lot of confusion in the whole community about it in the first few weeks. I had an impulse. I also think there was a lot of confusion about, in a funny way, the president and administration didn't go out and do much conversing about this. People were somewhat surprised by it. They certainly didn't understand necessarily all of the history of the region and what the, who all of these people might be, unless they had been doing a lot of reading on it and paying a lot of attention. And it was awfully hard in the last year or so to pay attention to international politics. So I think people were somewhat surprised by it. It's just good that people are taking action now. Mm-hmm. I think it's having an impact. I think you can see the change that might take place, at least on a larger level, and the influence that people can have.
Which brings us to Representative Farr's Stevenson Dining Hall. Pretty big turnout.
It was a good turnout. Yeah. It wasn't packed.
But it was pretty full.
Yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm.
I was only there for less than an hour. I had to go back to office hours, but I thought it was interesting enough.
I know that what I was concerned about, a question that was never asked of Representative Farr, was he made his proposal. There's a discrepancy between his request to Clinton for a 72-hour bombing and his bill on the House floor, which seems to talk about an indefinite bombing, but then it also tends to put it on a par with a number of other demands, such as there be the ethnic cleansing stop, refugees return, and so forth, all laudable aims. And when I talked to him afterward, and he did so very begrudgingly, well, with all his protectors, objecting at great length, I asked him, had he read the Rambouillet agreements, the repudiation of which, or the refusal to sign them, being the basis for this bombing by Milosevic? And he said no. We'd asked him this question a week ago when we occupied his office and were arrested there. And we asked him, we gave him a list of 10 questions we asked him to answer. Is the use of cluster bombs justified? Is the use of uranium depleted weapons? Some of these questions came up, of course, in the course of this forum. But the answers he gave seemed to me to be the answers of a politician. Now, you might say, well, he is a politician. Come on. But that didn't satisfy us, I guess, because for a lot of us, this is not a matter of giving a politician an opportunity to play one group in Peoria and the other group on the other side of town. We're looking for someone who's willing to take a stand against the war, or at least to know what Farr's position is. Is he taking a stand against the war, or is he playing to a liberal constituency with his eye to the election coming up? What was your impression? Do you feel that, I have to tell you, I feel he made no strong stand against the bombing. He tried to talk about his anti-war days, and he was a hippie, and all this stuff. But in essence, it wasn't an indication of a real moral shift. And he never apologized for the many thousands of people who have died, the many hundreds of thousands of refugees created by his votes in the Congress.
The way I read it, I don't think he feels apologetic about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I don't think so either.
I don't, I don't presume, as much as you are, that he necessarily has to, but I think he's not at all apologetic about it. In fact, the way I would describe it, and I've described it to him, the 72-hour hold and those kinds of things, they don't reflect the way that I feel about the situation. And the what you're talking about in the House resolution, the long sort of preface that talks about Milosevic and ethnic cleansing and all of that, is not...
What I'm really talking about is...
It's not the way that I interpret why we are there. I don't think we're there for humanitarian reasons, and I think to sort of reassert the rationalizations of Clinton is not necessarily the right way to understand the situation.
I wasn't even concerned about, and I don't mind his reasserting all his rationalizations. I have the same concern that you do, that it misreads history and misleads people and also doesn't look for a future solution with a clear background. My concern was the specific resolutions that he eventually comes up with. I have said for the last couple of weeks, whenever I could in a public forum, that I believe this bombing, this ceasefire and the bombing, is a prelude to a ground war.
Right. Well, he does make a statement in the resolution definitively saying that he will vote against any ground war.
Right.
I noticed that.
Right. Well, there is a problem, of course, and that was brought up in the forum, that he specifically voted to refuse to require Clinton to come back to Congress for a ground war vote. So, is he saying that he's going to vote against... You understand the problem.
I see the problem.
And I don't think he said, I will move to implement the War Powers Act or anything of that sort.
I see.
So that is a problem there.
Right. Well, I certainly am not in a position...
Go ahead.
...how he would negotiate, these waters that you're talking about. Maybe he can explain it. That's the kind of question. I wasn't there when the question was asked, so I don't know how he responded to it.
Right. There was a kind of a... I'm afraid that the next question, I guess, that I have for you has to do with the forum coming up on the 1st. On Tuesday, which I hope everybody listening to this broadcast comes to, and I guess the fear that the forum is going to be, it's not the one that we, the protesters, asked for from Representative Farr. We asked for a forum in which there will be give and take, back and forth, opportunity to do follow-up questions that would really pin Representative Farr down. And in a way, a little of that happened on Thursday, because Farr got emotionally involved, and there was a sort of an interchange that began to happen in spite of the attempts of the moderators to control and kind of, move everybody along in the forum. And that, I think, is what a lot of us want. We want to hear Representative Farr not just making his little political statements, or his packaged, comments, but really exposing his real views on the issue, even if we disagree with him. That's what I want to hear, and that's why I was glad after...
I'd love to hear it, too.
Yeah.
I would love to hear it, too, and I'm not certain you can do that in any civic auditorium or any of those kinds of situations, but boy, that would be the direction that I would like to see this go in, a conversation that had more give and take and the opportunity for people to clarify exactly what question they were asking him to answer.
I also tend to... Sorry, Tim, go ahead.
That would be very good. I think when the people sort of sat around and talked about how to organize the forum on the 1st, I think they were pushing hard to make sure that it was, let's say, one step better than the rest, and I'm not sure that it'll achieve what you're hoping to achieve. I don't know. I'm not absolutely sure what could achieve that, except this kind of conversation we're having right now. He needs to have that kind of conversation. Maybe if he had a smaller group and had a conversation with them in public, with the opportunity for a larger group to come. I mean, there might be some format that where you could actually work this out.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm assuming that the Civic Auditorium on June the 1st, 7 o'clock, I think is the time, I think that'll be a little bit better. I'm not certain that it will completely solve the problem you're talking about.
And of course, the real problem that I think both of us see beyond whatever Representative Farr's viewpoint is or resolution he introduces is how do we mobilize the community and the country to stop this war?
I think that's problem number one. I think problem number two is the real problem, which is what's the relationship of the United States in the 21st century to globalization, to globalized markets, to all of those things. I think that's the real problem. I think this war is going to go the way this war goes, and it's going to be held as the justification for intervention by NATO, no matter what the outcome is. And I'm a little bit concerned. I think it's symbolic, and I think the president has seen it as symbolic right from the start. I'm assuming that they're going to somehow declare victory, no matter what the outcome, and then I'm worried about what's going to happen after this. And so I would love to have a conversation with Mr. Ford.
And you've been listening to Councilmember Tim Fitzmaurice until we ran out of tape, and out of time, actually, since this happened earlier this morning, on the resolution by the City Council last Tuesday, Sam Farr's appearance on Friday, Sam Farr's general positions on the war, and the upcoming forum on June 1st, on Tuesday, at the Civic Auditorium, where Farr will be reappearing, no doubt heavily surrounded by police officers, or with a lot of that happening in the wings. I just got the word, by the way, from Lydia in a phone message that the City Council is uninterested in helping with the Arnold specifically, I think this was the person she mentioned, and me misquoting her on this, but I believe she said that we are concerned that the City Council ask that all charges be dropped against war protesters essentially engaged in peaceful protest. And the response of the City Council, somehow through her, to her, has been, oh, well, the arrests were in Sam Farr's office in the county building. It's a county matter. Well, I'm sorry, the county building is also in the city, and it may be that the jurisdiction of the deputies covers the county building, although some have said, why weren't the SCPD making arrests? They frequently do, or they're there as well. The City Council certainly has the power to recommend that charges be dropped against anyone anywhere in the country. They asked for a new trial for Mumia Abu-Jamal. There's no reason they can't demand a fair treatment of their own protesters in their own city of Santa Cruz. Except, of course, that's kind of a hot issue. You know, it might involve stepping on a few toes. Sheriff Tracy might go, ouch. Or Sam Farr might say, It's the same thing. We asked Farr to do something similar, and he said, oh, it's not my jurisdiction. Well, it's his office that will be filing trespass charges, or that filed the original complaint. So it obviously is his business. This is a form of pussyfooting around that I won't tolerate. I think it is outrageous when these kinds of lies and evasions take the place of real dialogue and real discussion. If you don't want to support the protesters in this regard, then say so. Say, nah, I don't think that's a good form of protest. I think we should wait around until Sam responds to his email. Fine. Then take that position if you want. Or, nah, I don't think it's appropriate to sit in somebody's office after business hours under any circumstances, even if people are dying by the hundreds over in Yugoslavia from the air, and conditions are being laid for plague, mass disease, death of young people, death of babies in the years to come by the destruction of the infrastructure. Well, then say so. You know, say what you mean. Don't pretend that it's not in your jurisdiction. Don't play these little games. And regarding Fitzmaurice, I have often criticized Councilmember Fitzmaurice on this show. I feel he had a disgraceful performance on the issue of homeless rights, both by omission and by commission. His refusal to bring up any issues of shelter throughout the winter, when it became quite clear, even from the majority, even from Rotkin in the right-wing minority, that there was completely inadequate shelter, and yet people were still getting arrested for sleeping, people were still getting harassed for sleeping, that people were criminalized for doing an action that we all have to do every night, yet Fitzmaurice's main concern was to make sure that people, bigots in the merchant community, bigots in the neighborhood organizations, didn't receive any nasty comments from people in the audience as they spoke. I remember that quite vividly. Fitzmaurice couldn't get it together to make any statements about shelter, to express any concerns about that issue whatsoever. Yet, you know, he was oh so concerned that these folks who have really wrong-headed views, and I say bigoted views, because they were talking about, the head of the Downtown Association, Peter Eberle, spoke about fears that homeless people would kidnap young people if they were allowed to sleep in vehicles in a distant area of the city. He was completely off. You know, I mean, maybe you might argue such a bigoted position more credibly if we were talking about lifting the sleeping ban in central areas of the city or in the neighborhoods, which we weren't. We were talking about lifting it in industrial areas. We were talking about lifting it far from most residential areas. Admittedly, Harvey West has as a joint function there, and that was one of the areas we were considering lifting it. But, you know, people with crazy views who were then shouted at by the audience who said, bullshit, which I think is a democratic and a natural response, and the kind of repression that Fitzmaurice was sanctioning and in fact initiating, because that's when Byers began threatening to arrest me at City Council. Byers, our great democratic leader, Byers, the woman who cuts off Phil Bear when he tries to respond to slanders from Mike Rotkin, Byers, the person who will not allow oral communication speakers to finish up, even if it only means another 6 minutes. Byers, who cuts off comment in public hearings on the sleeping ban to 2 minutes per speaker. I'm afraid I'm going at a number of people here, kind of jumping around, but I think we have to understand, I'm glad when Tim Fitzmaurice speaks out sensibly on the war, although I really, the academic approach to this whole thing, which I know is his approach. He wants to see a public forum on an issue and see people debating back and forth and come to some conclusions and so forth. And it's, you know, it's based on his training and it's based on his experience. And I frankly would like the same kind of thing. But in the meantime, when there is a pressing issue, it is essential that we take action to end it, whether it be trollbuster attacks on homeless people, which are happening in spite of all our good investigations by Sergeants Clark and Baker and Officer Seeley out at the Homeless Services Center. And I speak with some sarcasm because these officers have never been notably concerned with the rights of homeless people. Quite the contrary. In the past, their record is generally bad on these issues. Clark is known as the kicker. Butchie Baker was known for mercilessly harassing homeless people in the early 90s. He gave one older disabled man 3 tickets in one night in July of 1990. Well, this is a decade ago, and you say I'm dragging up old issues. Sure. And Baker, since, led an investigation of people who beat up homeless people in 1995, and the district attorney did convict 3 people. But in the most recent whole series of beatings, where we were receiving reports as early as January, Baker made no public statements, didn't go to the media on the issue, didn't return my phone calls on the issue in the last couple of months when I continued to ask him for information. And only reason he comes out when the spotlight of media is upon the issue. That's when he comes out. And we're actually going to get into this issue in more detail with Lou Rice, if he's had the patience to hang out. We're going to do that shortly. Before I leave the issue of the war, which I'm going to do, I want to read this flyer that I wrote for the Friday forum with FAR that we had two days ago up at Stevenson College. How many body bags have been ordered for the ground war? Representative FAR is the main heading of the flyer. A 72-hour ceasefire with surrender demands followed by renewed bombing in a ground war is a cruel joke. FAR's H.R. 196 does not require Clinton to seek congressional authorization for a ground war, but only opposes it if he comes to Congress seeking support. Time to bite the bullet and do the same thing. Stop the bombing now and forever today. Repudiate your April pro-war votes against ordering Clinton to withdraw U.S. forces from the Yugoslav conflict. Change your vote that was against prohibiting Clinton from using ground troops without Congress's okay. Make it clear that he needs Congress's okay to send in those ground troops. Reverse the vote that you had authorizing the current airstrikes against Yugoslavia. Don't just say it's a nice idea, which is what your current resolution says. Don't just say, oh, please, Mr. President, stop bombing for 72 hours. You've won. Declare victory and get out. No, say it's failed. Not the policy has succeeded, but it has failed. Let's look at the facts. You cannot base this kind of thing on bogus claims, because Clinton will turn around and say, we have not yet destroyed the infrastructure. We have not yet gotten all the tanks. There are a few planes hiding out here and there. We haven't been successful in going after this the way we have to. And that can be the basis for simply rejecting Farr and his little band of Democratic congressmen. And he knows that, unless he's completely brainless. Although we did shout at the demonstration, far, far, weaken the cranium, you support depleted uranium, something he seems to profess no knowledge of. So anyway, we ask him to repudiate these votes. We ask him to vote against military authorizations for Kosovo. It's kind of late now. He voted for $12 billion plus, only $1 billion of which goes to the refugees. We ask him to support implementation of the War Powers Act, which requires you don't put troops in the country for more than 60 days without Congress going to Congress and getting authorization, or they get pulled out. Now, that's never been enforced by the courts. It's time for him to join the lawsuit so they do get pulled out. It's time to acknowledge that the Yugoslav conflict is a civil war and educate American people to end atrocities on both sides. It's time to join President Carter, ex-President Carter, in condemning the bombing of civilians and innocents in Yugoslavia. It's time to take a leadership role in reversing the incalculable damage done by NATO in this war, including giving the Yugoslavs a blank check to run in and run amok in terms of their own atrocities in the Civil War process. Carter himself made a very good statement, I thought, a couple of days ago in an editorial. And that editorial, which I'm thumbing through to find right now, Have We Forgotten the Path to Peace, was published, I believe, it was the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, I'm not sure. I'm going to read a little bit of it, and then I'm going to turn to homeless topics more locally. Have We Forgotten the Path to Peace by Jimmy Carter. After the Cold War, many expected the world would enter an era of unprecedented peace and prosperity. Those who live in developed nations might think this is the case today, with the possible exception of the war in Kosovo. But at the Carter Center, we monitor all serious conflicts in the world, and the reality is that the number of such wars has increased dramatically. One reason is that the United Nations was designed to deal with international conflicts, and almost all the current ones are civil wars in developing countries. This creates a peacemaking vacuum that is most often filled by powerful nations that concentrate their attention on conflicts that affect them, like those in Iraq, Bosnia, and Serbia. While the war in Kosovo rages and dominates the world's headlines, even more destructive conflicts in developing nations are systematically ignored by the United States and other powerful nations. One can traverse Africa from the Red Sea in the northeast to the southwestern Atlantic coast and never step on peaceful territory. 50,000 people have recently perished in the war between Eritrea and Ethiopia, and almost 2 million have died during the 16-year conflict in neighboring Sudan. That war has now spilled into northern Uganda, whose troops have joined those from Rwanda to fight in the Democratic Republic of Congo, formerly Zaire. The other Congo, in Brazzaville, is also ravaged by civil war, and all attempts to bring peace to Angola have failed. Although formidable commitments are being made in the Balkans, where white Europeans are involved, no such concerted efforts are being made by leaders outside of Africa to resolve the disputes. This gives the strong impression of racism. Because of its dominant role in the United Nations Security Council and NATO, the United States tends to orchestrate global peacemaking. Unfortunately, many of these efforts are seriously flawed. We have become increasingly inclined to sidestep the time-tested premises of negotiation, which in most cases prevent deterioration of a bad situation and at least offer the prospect of a bloodless solution. Abusive leaders can best be induced by the simultaneous threat of consequences and the promise of reward, at least legitimacy within the international community. The approach the United States has taken recently has been to devise a solution that best suits its own purposes, recruit at least tacit support in whichever forum it can best influence, provide the dominant military force, present an ultimatum to recalcitrant parties, and then take punitive action against the entire nation to force compliance. The often tragic result of this final decision is that already oppressed citizens suffer, while the oppressor may feel free of further consequences if he perpetrates even worse crimes. Through control of the news media, he is often made to seem heroic by defending his homeland against foreign aggression and shifting blame for economic or political woes away from himself. Our general purposes are admirable, to enhance peace, freedom, democracy, human rights, and economic progress. But this flawed approach is now causing unwarranted suffering and strengthening unsavory regimes in several countries, including Sudan, Cuba, Iraq, and the most troubling example, Serbia. There, the international community has admirable goals of protecting the rights of Kosovars and ending the brutal policies of Slobodan Milosevic. But the decision to attack the entire nation has been counterproductive, and our destruction of civilian life has now become senseless and excessively brutal. There is little indication of success after more than 25,000 sorties and 14,000 missiles and bombs, 4,000 of which were not precision-guided. The expected few days of aerial attacks have now lengthened into months, while more than a million Kosovars have been forced from their homes, many never to return even under the best of circumstances. As the American-led force has expanded targets to inhabited areas and resorted to the use of anti-personnel cluster bombs, the result has been damage to hospitals, offices, and residences of a half dozen ambassadors, and the killing of hundreds of innocent civilians and an untold number of conscripted troops. Instead of focusing on Serbian military forces, missiles and bombs are now concentrating on the destruction of bridges, railways, roads, electric power, and fuel and fresh water supplies. Serbian citizens report that they are living like cavemen and their torment increases daily. Realizing we must save face but cannot change what has already been done, NATO leaders now have three basic choices: to continue bombing ever more targets until Yugoslavia, including Kosovo and Montenegro, is almost entirely destroyed, to rely on Russia to resolve our dilemma through indirect diplomacy, or to accept American casualties by sending military forces into Kosovo. So far, we are following the first and worst option and seem to be moving toward the third. Despite earlier denials by American and other leaders, the recent decision to deploy a military force of 50,000 troops on the Kosovo border confirms that the use of ground troops will be necessary to assure the return of expelled Albanians to their homes. How did we end up in this quagmire? We've ignored some basic principles that should be applied to the prevention or resolution of all conflicts. Short-circuiting the long-established principles of patient negotiation leads to war, not peace. Bypassing the Security Council weakens the United Nations and often alienates permanent members who may be helpful in influencing warring parties. The exclusion of non-governmental organizations from peacemaking precludes vital second-track opportunities for resolving disputes. Ignoring serious conflicts in Africa and other underdeveloped regions deprives these people of justice and equal rights. Even the most severe military or economic punishment of oppressed citizens is unlikely to force their oppressors to yield to American demands. The United States' insistence on the use of cluster bombs designed to kill or maim humans is condemned almost universally and brings discredit on our nation, as does our refusal to support a ban on landmines. Even for the world's only superpower, the ends don't always justify the means. That's a speech by ex-President Jimmy Carter, 39th President of the U.S., chairman of the nonprofit Carter Center, which seeks to advance peace and health throughout the world. Now, I have numerous issues with that speech, and I'm a little worried that I hope he's not supporting a ground war here, but he's certainly coming out against the brutality of the bombing. So I think that insofar as Clinton is afraid to go into a ground war and is going to continue bombing the hell out of the country, this is a productive speech, and I think it's useful to look at. The questions we had for Representative Farr, there were originally 10 of them. We expanded them to 13, but there are 10 he just hasn't answered. I'm going to read before we turn to the homeless issue, because I think they're questions he should answer by, he should have answered, well, by last week and did not. He apparently didn't even educate himself to read the Rambouillet Accords. I will hopefully play a bit of my dialogue with him afterward, in which he admitted that. And these questions need to be brought up at the forum. So I encourage us to divvy these up and present them. They should be presented en masse as from the Santa Cruz Coalition to Stop the Bombing to the moderators, I guess, by Tuesday noon. And give a call to 423-HUFF to get the number on where to do that, which I should have with me, but of course I don't. The 13 questions, the original 10 questions were, will you act to immediately ban NATO's use of deadly depleted uranium munitions? The original question was, do you support it? But we're making it stronger. Second one was, will you act to permanently end a bombing campaign that has already killed hundreds of civilians, over 1,200 by some estimates? The questions were actually designed two weeks ago, so obviously the numbers have increased. If that means collateral damage of thousands more maimed by casually producing cluster bombs now being dropped by tens of thousands from B-52s. They're using unguided bombs now, and they've come out justifying that. They're cheaper, and apparently the toleration for civilian casualties is now higher. So, as it is in most wars, the brutality is increasing, particularly since the U.S. seems to suffer no consequences from it. There's no casualties. There are no body bags coming back yet. Or perhaps no casualties we've heard of. There are claims that planes have been lost, and there have been significant casualties that are being suppressed. And more on that in a later show. You deny the bombing violates the 1949 Geneva Convention and their 1977 protocols, with NATO systematically destroying water installations, sanitation systems, power plants, civilian bridges, pharmaceutical factories, and other, quote, infrastructure essential to civilian survival. And, of course, as we've just heard, Jimmy Carter is concerned about that, as are numerous other people like George Soros, the billionaire financier who supported the in the Prohibition of Marijuana campaign and medicinal marijuana in the United States, and has been a big fundraiser for Democratic Party causes. Four, do you deny the bombing violates the 1945 Nuremberg Charter, which defines war crimes as the wanton destruction of cities, towns, or villages not justified by military necessity? Five, do you deny this war is a violation of the UN Charter, which requires Security Council approval for collective military action against other states? B, a violation of NATO's own defensive-only military alliance charter. C, a violation of the 1980 Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties that outlaws the coercion or threats of force to compel governments to sign any treaty or agreement. And D, a violation of the Helsinki Final Accords of 1975, which guarantees the territorial borders of all the nations of Europe, including Yugoslavia. Six, these are all questions for Representative Farr, which he's declined to answer in writing. Do you feel any government would have been able to sign the Rambouillet Agreement, which specifically allows stationing of foreign troops anywhere in Yugoslavia, not just Kosovo, and requires Yugoslavia to support their upkeep and, in essence, relinquish sovereignty to the U.S. and its NATO allies? Seven, do you deny that Clinton's bombing campaign has already resulted in catastrophic environmental damage to the Danube, with tons of crude oil and lethal chemicals poisoning the longest river in Europe and source of drinking water for 10 million people? 8. Do you deny the KLA was identified by the U.S. as a terrorist group financed through the largest heroin trade in Europe? 9. Do you deny that the bombing is creating many times more refugees than any Yugoslavian offensive against the KLA could, and solidifying Yugoslavians in hatred against the U.S.? And finally, 10. Are you willing to risk nuclear war with China and Russia in a bombing campaign now overfunded with your votes that is escalating into a huge ground war of 500 million people against a Kentucky-sized nation of 10 million against a population even the Nazis were unable to subdue in World War II? And then I added three questions to this that I thought we should present. Will you act immediately to permanently end the bombing and the undeclared war in Yugoslavia before more innocents on both sides die? 12. Will you publicly repudiate President Clinton's calculated policy of daily escalation, expansion of bombing targets, apparent sabotage of diplomatic efforts, violent intervention in a distant civil war, and lead a peace movement to restore sanity before this generation's Vietnam swallows all of us? And finally, 13, will you take action now to stop Clinton's planned ground war before it starts, a war you have facilitated through your uncorrected April votes that gave him a blank check to proceed without having to return to Congress? These are questions that Farr has been asked for several weeks to answer. He has had the opportunity. He has a nice staff that can get to work and on these questions and answer them. He should have these answers ready when he shows up at the forum and should be distributing a flyer at that forum, distributing his information to the community as to what his answers are to these questions. That is what we should be discussing at the forum. The answers to these questions. We shouldn't have to be wasting our time giving the same questions again and again and getting the same dodges. There's no need. He knows the questions. We know he knows the questions. He knows we know he knows the questions. So what's the holdup? The holdup has to be he's using this as a public relations forum for his own purposes. That is something that does not facilitate ending this war. It may facilitate his political career. It may facilitate the re-election of some Democrat or the election of some Democrat in the year 2000. That is not the interest that most of us have. For those who have that interest, let them go have another fundraiser for the Democratic Party. For those of us who have an interest in stopping the bombing, let's make sure, by disregarding attempts to cram this forum into a format which allows Farr to avoid these questions, let's make sure that we demand answers to these questions. And if he doesn't, let's stand up and say, answer the question. And let's not be deterred by men in blue with guns and badges or by moderators saying, oh, sit down, you'll have a chance to speak at the end of the meeting. Let's not be deterred by that. Let's not be disruptive in any chaotic way, but let's be real clear about what we want at that forum. Let's make sure that the public, and hopefully this forum will be televised. I'm not sure that it is yet. I haven't heard that it's going to be, but it should be. Let's make sure that the public sees the people standing up, hears the demands that these questions be answered, and then sees if they are. That's what I ask all of us to do at this forum coming up on Tuesday. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and at last, a phone call.
Hi, you're on the air.
And if it were to be televised, it would bump my program, so we can't have that.
This sounds like my producer here.
Yes. I do have word about the status of whether the the Sam Farr Forum on Tuesday at the Civic will be televised.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a film crew there from community television, but it will not be broadcast live.
I see.
And I just spoke to Jeff Dunn, who's executive director at community television, and he said that that tape will be made available to any programmer at at community television who wants it.
Well, I'm glad he's doing that, although I think
he's also seeking a three-hour block in which to rebroadcast it, but that hasn't been worked out yet, when they can make that three-hour block to rebroadcast that available. So it will be broadcast at some point, but not live.
Well, perhaps if people want to influence his decision, is there a number they can call?
Now, I'm unclear about that. No, that's not possible. It's just a logistical reason. They didn't have enough time to be able to set up the live broadcast. But as to the other number about where we're going, supposed to have our questions submitted by noon on Tuesday, and by the way, any organization that's listening that does have questions that want to be submitted to Sam Farr at that Tuesday forum need to have those submitted in writing by Tuesday at noon. I don't know where.
Yeah, I think Lydia is the person to call, and since I don't have Lydia's number here, I would suggest people call 423-HUFF, 423-4833.
Yeah, we'll try to make that information available as soon as we get it.
Well, thank you. Yo, Santa Cruz, you're on the air.
Hi there. I just tuned in, and I need to know when this forum is.
Okay, the forum, actually there are several of them, but
the one with Farr.
The one with Farr is coming up on Tuesday, 7 o'clock at the Civic Auditorium, and the next one, the day after, on the issue of the war, is at the Veterans Hall at 7 o'clock on June 2nd.
Tuesday, 7, Santa Cruz.
7. Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Love by the gasworks cross, dreamed a dream by the old canal, kissed my girl by the factory wall, dirty old town, dirty old town. Thank you. old dead tree. Dirty old town, dirty old town.
Another one of my favorites from Ewan McCall and Peggy Seeger, Dirty Old Town. Might be applied to a town you know. I mean, some towns look mighty clean on the outside, but on the inside, not so. Towns often may keep their streets spotless, but remove the people for whom the streets are designed to be used. We've seen that in places like San Francisco, places like New York City, where the poorest people are swept out of town in order to facilitate commerce for the more wealthy and for the tourists. With me in the studio, munching chocolate chip cookies, as I am as well, and a very bad dietary decision, I have with me that man who's apparently done enough reducing for 1 month or 1 year, maybe for a lifetime, in a homeless fast where he was concerned about the rights of people. Clients of the Homeless Services Center, the homeless community in Santa Cruz, and spent 27 days fasting in order to get the attention of the somewhat ATD-challenged board of directors of the Homeless Services Center. And again, his opinions, I want to remind you, are mine, and he will give his own opinions, I'm sure, in a moment. Lou Rice. And Lou, let's check your mic. How are we doing?
Crunch, crunch, crunch. 10, 9, 8, 7, 5, 6, 4, 3, 2, 1.
That's good. Okay, Lou, we've got you on the mic, and we last had you in the studio on Thursday when I guess you you listened to me and Rotkin, Councilmember Rotkin, kind of debate, begin the opening salvos in the debate on the sleeping ban. We talked about the magnet theory. You made a proposal that why not simply legalize camping under the freeways where it's currently happening, particularly given the current crisis, not just the shelter crisis, where people have no choice but to sleep outside and camp, but people are suffering because if they protect themselves by sleeping in groups, they're likely to be hassled by police, or they have to fear, at least, being hassled by police under the existing go-to-sleep-after-11-o'clock, go-to-jail law that the City Council passed at Mayor Byers' initiative back in March. You proposed to Councilmember Rotkin, they're already setting up under the freeways. Why not have a legalized emergency zone there, at least for a period of time? And then if more people began to use it too much so, it could be ended. Wasn't that your proposal?
Yeah, he was concerned about the magnet theory, and I think anybody in their right mind should be. If you develop something that is good for your needs now, say you got a 200 person need, if you develop something, whether it's an indoor shelter or an outdoors free zone, and it becomes, say, twice or three times that amount of individuals flux in for this, I told him, you know, if the magnet theory was there, and it was, you know, no community wants to see their problem enlarged by something that they do for the people that are in the community because of people's desire to come and squat for the benefits of that.
Well, Lou, you know, we actually began talking about this. I got a fine list of questions from my producer to run by Councilmember Rotkin. We didn't have much time to go into them, but we did start the discussion with that magnet theory question. And one thing I pointed out to Councilmember Rotkin is that the task force to examine the camping ordinance, as they called themselves, Councilmembers Byers, Croon, and those three really all agreed that there was no magnet theory. That is to say that there was a magnet theory, but the magnet theory had no validity in various counties, like places where the sleeping ban had been lifted or campgrounds had been set up, like Broward County, like Dade County in Miami, like Santa Barbara from 1986 to 1989, which lifted the sleeping portions of its camping ban, like Eugene in 1997-98. that the magnet theory was shown to be a magnet myth. And I should remind our audience, and I reminded Councilmember Rotkin, I think, that these are the same people, at least in the form of buyers, who voted to support the Rotkin position on keeping the sleeping ban. So they favored, she favored the sleeping ban, I guess Kroon and Sugar did not, to their credit. But she agreed, and so did Fitzmaurice, I believe, although I'm not misquoting him, that there was, the magnet theory has been shown to be a myth, at least in terms of the general argument that if you lift the law against sleeping or moderate it in certain zones, everybody is going to come to that zone. Now, Councilmember Rotkin's claim in response to that, Lou, was, well, look at the Coral Street Open Air Shelter in 1995. Everybody came in the winter, and there was this huge number of people, and all these problems were created. And my response to that was, in the winter, it becomes a particularly difficult situation. In the winter, you have a situation, you also had a situation where there was a continued upsurge of harassment in San Francisco, which was driving people out of San Francisco, not driving people into Santa Cruz, but when they got here, they were using the facilities they found. But during the summer, that's what we're talking about. I brought this to Councilmember Rotkin's attention. We're not talking about during the winter, that campground was open for 3 summers, and there was never an influx problem reported by the social service agencies watching it, specifically the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, or what was then Karen Gillette's Homeless Service Center, now Ken Cole heads that body. So I claim to him, the magnet theory has generally been shown to be a magnet myth, and in the one case you've presented, during the summer, there is no evidence there's going to be a mass upsurge. And more important than all of that, we have people getting beaten. And something has to be done about that in terms of safety, or we're going to have a war here going on. What's your sense of that, Lou?
Well, the one magnet theory that's not a theory is the theory of gravity. We can't leave the planet, you know. So that is a reasonable thing. But if you will recall here 4 or 5 years ago, they had up in Kennebunkport a very talented bunch of people from all over the world. Medical people. And the whole thing was to address the needs of humanity today. And
what one group of people, Lou, I'm sorry.
What is the name of it?
What was the situation?
The situation was basically the same things we're dealing with today. Homeless people, rejected, dejected people of society, poor, poverty, medical that wasn't available.
This was a seminar?
Yeah, it was considered a seminar, a brainstorming event. And I can't think of his name, but he was the press secretary for Lyndon Johnson, was like the host of the thing. It was done for public television. Mm-hmm. But he had some very wise people there. And in the end, he had a summation minute or two with some of them. Some of the economics and some of the medical people, some of the spiritual people. And he asked the Dalai Lama, he said, what is your answer for these problems? And I'll never forget, the guy said, clean your own house and stop abusing your children.
And that was something actually we brought up, and again, the discussion with Rotkin about my proposal that the city or the volunteers from homeless rights organizations get together kind of seminars on how to camp lightly on the land and what needs to be done there. I think that could be done in terms of literature, in terms of lectures by people who have done it before. I think that kind of information could be put out broadly and might have a real salutary effect. What's your view on that,
Boy Scouts. You know, they would be a great, great.
Maybe you could send in NATO. NATO would then have a real function.
Well, I think NATO does have a real function. You know, I know in the past there wasn't a NATO, there wasn't a League of Nations, there was no United Nations. Mm. And most of the problems that could have been squelched in infancy wound up being hellacious trauma for the whole entire world.
This is, of course, a real bag of worms. And perhaps at some point we can talk about this, but I'm hoping to again, return to the focus on our own. It was a facetious comment on my part about NATO, as
okay.
I'm sure you know. although I would love to see NATO dropping food packages in, you know, instead of bombs. That's my motto: food, not bombs.
Well, NATO, United Nations, have did that.
I guess they've started.
They did it in Somalia. They did it in Rwanda. They did it several places.
I don't think NATO did it, but the UN has done it. But anyway, let me ask
you
this.
The United States military was heavy into it, which is a member of NATO.
Mm. The California Homeless Civil Rights Update, Lou, is a kind of an article I write every month for the homeless paper Street Sheet in San Francisco. And this month I wrote the following article. I'd like to get some of your reactions to it. I think you've read it, but I'd like to read it for the folks on the air and then get your thoughts on it. At Santa Cruz, authorities stonewall homeless beatings is how it's headed. Five homeless people have reported beatings within 3 weeks, and that could be just the tip of the iceberg. The beating of homeless people is a form of sport, which what was dubbed troll busting in the mid-80s has returned to Santa Cruz with a vengeance. When two men were so seriously savage that they went to the hospital, they actually filed police reports, leading to the first ever story on these homeless hate crimes in the local Monopoly Daily, the Santa Cruz Sentinel, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Wall Street Journal. Even then Santa Cruz Police Sergeant Steve Clark, notorious as a longtime harasser of the homeless, tried to downplay the recent atrocities by claiming that the one incident reported was the first, quote, in several years. Larry Cessna, who publicly criticized the police department for ignoring a beating that put him in the hospital in January, soon received a citation for open container, which threatened him because he was on probation. Though he raised the issue in front of three city council members supposedly, quote, investigating the sleeping ban at hearings held in the homeless dining area itself, police never found any suspects, and the beatings continued. Civil Liberties attorney Kate Wells attempted her attempt to get city council to set up an emergency sleeping area as a safety zone got no support from the city council. Mayor Catherine Byers, who also sits on the board of the Homeless Services Center, responded to recent reports of a gang of skinhead assailants prowling the homeless sleeping areas with clubs and pipes by suggesting that she might put the matter on the agenda in late June. That's the agenda of the Homeless Services Center, not the agenda of the City Council, for discussion, leaving those without shelter to dodge police and thugs in the month ahead. Sleeping and covering up with blankets is still a $54 crime in the city limits. The County Council recently ruled that vehicular sleeping on public property was illegal in the county as well, unless you're a motorist driving through who engages in emergency, quote, roadside resting. The summer emergency shelter program serves only 28 of the city's 500 to 1,500 homeless. It turns away 6 to 7 people each night, literally forcing the most vulnerable to become both criminals under the sleeping ban and the prey of criminals. The sleeping ban and city council indifference make reporting violence against the poor pointless and even dangerous. More than half of all sleeping tickets go to warrant, which means that homeless people can be arrested, lose their vehicles, and face higher fines. Corrupt local judge John Meatgrinder Mulligan arrogantly and methodically misinforms homeless defendants that they have no right to a jury trial or a public defender for such failure to appear warrants. Enmeshing his victims in a schedule of fines and or forced community service for which yet another fee may be demanded. Recently, homeless vehicle dweller Dennis Ring successfully raised the Edwards Flurry defense. Based on the legal peculiarity that A, jail is supposedly not a judicial option for one convicted of the low crime of infraction, as distinguished from the more serious crimes of misdemeanor or felonies, and B, hence, even if one refuses to pay a fine or do community service, if you're convicted of an infraction, the court has no option other than civilly suing the homeless defendant for the costs involved, that is, say, suggesting the prosecutor or the city attorney do that, which means that jail for the sleeping ban is essentially an unconstitutional remedy. All of this stems from the legal peculiarity that while there is a law which makes it a misdemeanor not to pay a vehicular fine, sleeping bans, even in vehicles, are not considered vehicular. They are considered non-vehicular, and there is no specific state law that criminalizes not paying a non-vehicular fine. Dennis Rehm refused to pay his fine, declaring that he would rather go to jail. The judge suppressed the warrant against him, though he warned that Rehm would get another warrant. But so far, and that's about three or four weeks ago, no warrants have been issued, and Dennis continues to sleep in his vehicle. What do you think about all this? I know I'm throwing a lot at you. Has any of that struck your fancy, Lou, or any thoughts on any of that?
Well, if I don't have a legal place to roll out my bedroll or shelter myself from the environment or from the hunters, I don't call them trail busters. When I was doing some game hunting, it was usually a certain prey that I was after. When you select the prey, you're hunting it. You're not going out and troll busting. Now there's a difference when human beings search out an individual part of the populace and try to destroy them and injure them. Now that is my belief. And you know, this country, especially in the civil rights areas, prior to the civil rights changes that came about from a great number of ways, you know, these were addressed. As far as the arrest of a person that is found in violation of these quote laws, I think it is proper when a person is arrested to be Mirandized in the United States of America. And in the Mirandized statement, given your rights, you have the right to an attorney. And if you cannot afford one, one will be appointed for you. So there should be some investigation into that. Because without a person being Mirandized, it's an illegal arrest, from what I understand. And, you know, these are things that have to be corrected. And they will be. You know, if people are not being legally arrested and told their rights, you know, they are at a misfortune to begin with.
Let me suggest this. I know that I've been really kind of impatient with Ken Cole, the Homeless Services Center person, although I really am much pleased by comparing him with the previous executive director, Karen Gillette, who, frankly, from my perspective, is utterly impossible around this whole issue. And indeed, I feel, given the prestige she had among politicians downtown and other social service providers, given the power she had, she essentially let this beating situation continue without any public statements, without any attempt to remedy, without bringing it to her board of directors month after month. And Ken Cole, to his credit, brought it to the May board of directors. And we actually talked to Becky Johnson last Thursday. I guess the board meeting was last Thursday, and there was some discussion of it. Again, we heard, unfortunately, Mayor Byers also on the board. Her response was not to say, yes, let's set up an emergency camping area immediately so people at risk will have a safe place to sleep in the absence of any really, you know, better shelter alternative. Instead, it was, oh, let's talk about it at the next board meeting on the agenda. Thank you very much. Well, Ken Cole has taken the initiative. He set up this, the meeting was a week ago, Thursday, of the board. He set up this meeting last Thursday where you and I were both present listening to the three police officers talking to a lot of homeless clients about beatings and their perspective on that and trying to kind of reassure people. And we're going to talk about that in a moment. I'm going to play a few selections from that. But there is another meeting planned for next Thursday, again at 2:30 at 115 Coral Street, for those of you out there who are interested, 2:30 this coming Thursday, to talk about homeless services and their inadequacies. And I think this is an area that you would be particularly interested in, because actually that is why you you starved yourself for 27 days, right?
Yeah, I wanted what was being done at the present to be improved, And I've been told that there was an awful lot of money involved in it. And when I spoke with these people in the influence in the homeless shelter deal, the mayor and some of the other board members, they told me it was like minimal to improve these. I know the one thing that is costly is the drinking fountain. But you know, if you go to your schoolhouse or you go to your courthouse or any area downtown where people frequent, there are drinking water fountains. So, you know, it's not an unreasonable request. And I was sort of disappointed with the time element that it was taking to get this water fountain installed, because I have a little knowledge of plumbing and stuff, worked at it several years. And after being nearly 2 weeks off the fast, and the mayor had told me the day after I brought this to her attention that there was no place there to get a drink of water except out of the laboratories in the bathrooms or the mop sinks, she asked me, she said, "You are not allowed, no, you can't go into the office kitchen and get you a drink of water?" And I told her, I said, "Miss Mayor," I said, "as far as I know, there isn't a kitchen in that office building." She said, "Yes, there is." I said, "Yeah, but I don't have access to it. It's strictly staffed." You know, and